There is something especially haunting about arriving in a place only to find it empty. Only relics of a human presence remaining. An empty main street in an old ghost town captivates our attention, for a moment at least, as we ponder, where is everybody? All of the visual clues remain. Empty homes, businesses, schools, and churches. To remind us that people were here, but now they're gone. Where did they go, and why? The question becomes even more intriguing when it involves a ship found abandoned. You can't just walk away from a ship on the sea. The concept of the ghost ship has long fascinated us, perhaps partly because it's hard to understand how a ship's entire human complement could vanish, or why they would voluntarily leave a boat that proved itself seaworthy long after they were gone. On November 10th, 1955, Captain Gerald Douglas of the merchant ship Tuvalu sighted the MV Hoyita in the South Pacific. It had left Samoa in the first week of October and was 5 weeks overdue to arrive in the Tokelau Islands, a territory of New Zealand, and nearly 800 miles off course. Through his binoculars, Captain Douglas could see that all was not well. The ship was listing heavily. The portside deck railing dipped below the surface of the waves, and the crew of the Tuvalu had to exercise caution when boarding. When it left port, there had been 25 people on board, 16 crew and 9 passengers, plus 4 tons of cargo. The boarding party found the ship barren and abandoned. There was blood, a doctor's bag, and signs that there had been trouble, but nobody was on board. Much of the cargo was missing, as were all of the lifeboats. This is the story of the MV Hoyita. One of the earliest ghost ship legends is that of the Flying Dutchman, a fictional tale, but likely based on highly romanticized real events during the heyday of the Dutch East Indies Trading Company. The first literary telling of the story of the Flying Dutchman is rather brief. From John MacDonald's travels in various parts of Europe, Asia, and Africa during a series of 30 years and upward, published in 1790. The weather was so stormy that the sailors said they saw the Flying Dutchman. The common story is that this Dutchman came to the Cape in distress of weather and wanted to get into harbor, but could not get a pilot to conduct her and was lost, and that ever since, in very bad weather, her vision appears. Later accounts are much more spooky and dramatic. From Chapter 6 of A Voyage to Botany Bay by George Barrington. I had often heard of the superstition of sailors respecting apparitions and doom, but had never given much credit to the report. It seems that some years since a Dutchman of war was lost off the Cape of Good Hope, and every soul on board perished, her consort weathered the gale and arrived soon after at the Cape. Having refitted and returning to Europe, they were assailed by a violent tempest nearly in the same latitude. In the night watch, some of the people saw, or imagined they saw, a vessel standing for them under a press of sail, as though she would run them down. One in particular affirmed it was the ship that had foundered in the former gale, and that it must certainly be her, or the apparition of her, but on its clearing up, the object, a dark thick cloud, disappeared. Nothing could do away with the idea of this phenomenon on the minds of the sailors, and on their relating the circumstances when they arrived in port, the story spread like wildfire, and the supposed phantom was called the Flying Dutchman. Barrington's account is thrilling, and the mental picture that it conjures, of a huge, black, ghostly ship appearing out of a dark rolling cloud, sailing straight for you, is incredible and haunting. The legend has been embellished and told in varying narratives over the years, with a sighting of the Flying Dutchman becoming both a portent of impending doom, and sometimes, punishment for a crime or misdeed previously committed. It's no wonder our collective consciousness has embraced and retold fantastical stories of ghost ships over the centuries. Perhaps that long-standing relationship with fictional, or fictionalized, tales of ghost ships has infected our perception of the phenomenon. In the rare instance that a ghost ship shows up in the real world, on the horizon, lazily drifting in the current, afloat but unguided, we immediately imagine the worst. The tale of the Mary Celeste is one example. The Mary Celeste was a real 103-foot, two-mast brigantine that hung acres of canvas, sails which still flew when she was found adrift near the Azores in the Atlantic in 1872, her entire crew missing but her cargo of denatured alcohol intact. Ever since, the Mary Celeste has been the subject of fascination and inspired two old-time radio plays, as well as numerous modern-day documentaries. As entrancing as they are, historical accounts of grand ghost ships wandering the seas lack something on the tangibility scale. Nobody alive has ever seen a ship like the Dutchman, other than restored relics and those in museums. And it's hard for the average person to imagine conditions aboard a ship on the ocean in the midst of a vicious squall, when there is no land in sight. The light of daytime becomes ethereal and otherworldly, and every wave is a roller coaster, like a road trip through a valley where the road is always moving. The vehicle constantly rocks back and forth, and the landscape will kill you if it gets the chance. The historic distance from tales like those of the Flying Dutchman and the Mary Celeste could be what makes the tale of the MV Hoyita more fascinating. The Hoyita was not a masted sailing vessel at the mercy of the wind and Mother Nature, but a wooden yacht from the era of diesel engines and generators. Surely it was equipped to safely make its voyage, right? In the beginning, the ship was a luxury yacht for director Roland West, whose silent films of the 1920s and 30s have been described as innovative proto-film noir. The yacht was a 69-foot twin-engined vessel constructed in Los Angeles in 1931. It was considered the height of luxury and boasted extras like oversized water and fuel tanks, and even an autopilot, which was new for the time. Roland West named it Hoyita, Spanish for jewel or gem, in honor of his wife, Jewel Carmen, a silent film actress. The naming is somewhat curious, considering Roland West had grown tired of his wife of 12 years by the time he commissioned the yacht, and the couple had become estranged by this point. West had met actress Thelma Todd on a yachting excursion to Catalina Island in 1930, beginning an affair, and would commission this ship the following year. It was a beautifully constructed wooden boat made of cedar over an oak timber frame, and it made many journeys to Catalina Island in the early years, with West treating his wife, his mistress, and his Hollywood admirers to flashy excursions on the water. Despite the outward appearance that everything in their life was fine, both Roland West and Jewel Carmen had dark days ahead of them. For context, we have to remember that this was the age of the talkies, and modern motion pictures had begun to supplant silent films with the release of The Jazz Singer in 1927. It was transformational to the industry, and history is replete with accounts of silent film veterans who could not make the transition. Actors with foreign accents found it harder to get work when they were required to speak. Actors from the theater world, so successful in silent films with their big, expressive mannerisms, found themselves handcuffed in films with sound, lest the swish of their clothing or sound of their footsteps ruin the recording. Roland and his wife were dinosaurs of a dying medium, and it surely must have added financial stress to their lives, on top of their ongoing marital drama. The Hoyita served as a welcome distraction over plenty of days and nights on the water in the tumultuous years from 1931 to 35, with West, Carmen, and Todd as passengers. At the same time, the domestic situation at the West Estate evolved. In 1934, Thelma Todd partnered with both Roland West and Jewel Carmen to open Thelma Todd's Sidewalk Cafe at 17575 Pacific Coast Highway in Pacific Palisades. The ground floor served customers as a restaurant, and the second floor housed two large apartments separated only by a sliding door. One apartment was Thelma's, and the other belonged to Roland West. A popular dance club was on the third floor, and the main residence that West shared with his wife, Jewel Carmen, was nearby. Perhaps their awkward living situation was reflective of views on divorce at the time. In the 1930s, filing for divorce still meant trying to prove adultery or cruelty or abandonment, a scary proposition if you were a public figure like Roland West. Whatever the reason, This unconventional three-way living arrangement continued until just before Christmas 1935. On Monday, December 16th, a maid went to Jewel Carmen's garage to retrieve a car, like she did every morning. She instead found Thelma Todd dead behind the wheel of her chocolate-colored 1934 Lincoln Phaeton convertible. The story from the Los Angeles Times read, in part, "Coagulated blood marred the screen comedian's features and stained her mauve and silver evening gown and her expensive mink coat when she was found, her blonde locks pathetically awry. In the front seat of her automobile in the garage of Roland West, film producer and director, in front of West's residence, less than 500 yards away from Miss Todd's cafe on the Roosevelt Highway." The days of carefree yachting excursions with his lover were over for Roland West. A very public investigation followed, and despite the finding of carbon monoxide as the cause of death, the police vowed that the investigation would persist. The LA Times reported that Thelma Todd had recently received several extortion letters from an unknown sender who demanded a $10,000 payment under threat of death. A dark cloud gathered over both Roland West and Jewel Carmen, and whispered questions made the rounds in Hollywood. Why was Todd found in Jewel Carmen's garage? And who sent the extortion letters? One conspiracy theory even involved a scenario in which Roland West had killed Thelma Todd on the Hoyita, then returned her to the home and staged the scene as a suicide. To be honest, the death of Thelma Todd deserves an episode all on its own, and who knows, maybe we'll get to that in the future. However, suffice it to say, the death of Thelma Todd was ruled accidental, and both Roland West and Jewel Carmen moved on with their lives. However, both of their careers were damaged by the scandal, and neither would ever fully recover. When exactly West sold the Hoyita is unclear, but he would divorce Jewel Carmen officially in 1938, so perhaps it was during this split or not long after. The boat was then owned by screen star Mary Pickford for a time, but by 1941, with the war in the Pacific in full swing, the Hoyita was acquired by the U.S. Navy. According to Hoyita, Solving the Mystery by David G. Wright, it was October of 1941 when the merchant vessel Hoyita became YP-108, Yard Patrol Boat No. 108, assigned to Pearl Harbor. While we don't know exactly what YP-108 was doing on December 7th during the attack on Pearl Harbor, obviously it survived. But unfortunately, there are no records that we've been able to find documenting what the vessel was doing on that day. The U.S. Navy would use YP-108 for the rest of the war in the South Pacific until 1943, when it ran aground and was badly damaged. The ship was repaired and put back to sea, but by 1946, it no longer met the Navy's requirements for service. YP-108 was then stripped of most of its hardware and pulled from service. YP-108 was gone, and the Hoyita was back. In 1948, a private company, the Lewis Brothers, bought Hoyita based primarily on its two 225-horsepower diesel engines by Gray Marine, and also two diesel generators for electrical power. The Lewis brothers then retrofitted the hull with cork lining, which would make the boat suitable for hauling refrigerated cargo. The boat then changed hands twice until, in 1952, it landed in the hands of Dr. Catherine Luamala, an American anthropologist from Hawaii. She then leased the boat to her love interest, Captain Thomas H. Miller, also known as Dusty Miller, a British sailor living and working in Samoa. Originally, Captain Miller attempted to start a fishing business with the Hoyita, but the venture failed. He was not a fisherman. For 7 months, Captain Miller lived on the Hoyita in the Apia Harbor, broke. Actually, worse than broke. He was in debt. He then began making plans to use the Hoyita for a charter and transportation business in the islands. Eventually, he secured a merchant contract to make copra runs between Samoa and the Tokelau's. Copra is the dried kernel of the coconut from which coconut oils are extracted, and Miller took the promise of an ongoing contract as a serious opportunity. This voyage of his began on October 3rd, 1955. You could say that the measure of a person's courage is proportional to the length of journey they're willing to take on the South Pacific, but inversely proportional to the size of the boat. The longer the journey and the smaller the boat, the bolder you are. In this case, the journey was expected to take about 2 days, from Samoa to the Tokelau Islands, anywhere from 41 to 48 hours, depending on the weather, and the Hoyita, a 69-foot boat, would carry 16 crew, 9 passengers, and 4 tons of cargo, including 80 empty 45-gallon drums. It's a journey that for most of us would take a little courage, but for the passengers and crew of the Hoyita, travel between the islands of the South Pacific was a way of life. The Hoyita was supposed to leave for Tokelau at noon the previous day, but was delayed because of a failed port engine clutch. The cargo was run-of-the-mill: food, medical supplies, construction materials, absolutely nothing out of the ordinary. The 16 crew members consisted of Captain Miller, Native American ship's mate Chuck Simpson, a bosun and an engineer, both from Kiribati, another engineer from Samoa, 6 seamen, 2 greasers and a cook, all from Tokelau, and 2 supercargo workers, James Walwork from Western Samoa and George Williams from New Zealand. The youngest passenger was just 3 years old, the adopted daughter of the oldest passenger aboard, 51-year-old pharmacist Takuma Lapana and his wife Tokelau Lapana. Their 11-year-old son also accompanied them on the voyage. Other notable passengers included Andy Parsons, a surgeon from Ireland on his way to perform an amputation, and Pete Perlis, a government official from New Zealand. Unfortunately, the crew had not been able to remedy the problem with the port engine clutch overnight, and Captain Miller chose to leave port with only one functioning engine. They set out at first light on October 3rd, 1955. The Hoyita was expected to arrive in Tokelau on October 5th. The day arrived in Tokelau, October 5th, and the hours ticked by. By noon, the Hoyita had not yet arrived. The weather was calm, and no passing ships or land-based stations in the region had reported any distress calls. 3 o'clock came and went, then 6 o'clock, and as the hours passed and the sun crept toward the horizon, there was no sign of the Hoyita. On October 6th, the port in Tokelau sent out a message: "The Hoyita is overdue." The government search and rescue commenced immediately using Sunderland flying boats from the Royal New Zealand Air Force. For 6 days, they searched more than 100,000 square miles of ocean, but there was no sign of the Hoyita. Then, on November 10th, just after dawn, Captain Gerald Douglas of the merchant ship Tuvalu spotted something in the distance in the waters north of Fiji. It was a ship. As the Tuvalu approached, it became clear that something was very wrong. The boat listed heavily to port, the railing bobbing in and out of the sea. There was no sign of anyone on deck. The name on the hull came into focus: Hoyita. Now, we're going to pause for just a moment to hear a word from today's sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by Nutrafol. 80 million men and women in the US experience thinning hair, yet it's still not openly talked about, which can make going through it feel scary and stressful, and that just adds to the problem. But thinning hair is not only common, it's normal. Nutrafol is physician-formulated to be 100% drug-free. They use natural, clinically effective botanicals for better hair growth through whole body health. On top of thicker, stronger hair without lasers or chemicals, Nutrafol's ingredients may also help you get a handle on better sleep, stress response, skin, nails, and libido. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support this show by going to Nutrafol.com and using the promo code UNRESOLVED to save $15 on your first month's subscription. This is their best offer available, and it is only available for US customers for a limited time. In addition to getting $15 off of your first month, this special offer also gets you free shipping on every order. So get $15 off and free shipping at Nutrafol.com by using the promo code UNRESOLVED at checkout. Once again, that's promo code UNRESOLVED for hair as strong as you are. Today's episode is also brought to you by Caliper CBD. I love to be lazy. Before I became a dad, I had the ability to be lazy all of the time. Now, not so much. The last year of my life has felt like a whirlwind, but nowadays I enjoy being lazy in much smaller increments. That's where Caliper CBD comes in. Caliper CBD creates dissolvable CBD powder that has no flavor, but is somehow more effective than CBD oils. With Caliper's powder clinically proven to deliver 30 times more CBD in the first 30 minutes than most CBD oils. And each of their packets are carefully measured to contain exactly 20 milligrams of CBD powder, so you can put zero effort into figuring out your dosage. Because not stressing is the entire point, right? Now, listeners of Unresolved can go flavorless with their CBD by ordering through Caliper CBD. Get 20% off of your first order by using the promo code UNRESOLVED at trycaliper.com/unresolved. Caliper is so confident in their product that you can try it risk-free for 30 days, and if you don't love it, they'll give you a full refund. Once again, that's trycaliper.com/unresolved. And don't forget to use the promo code UNRESOLVED at checkout to save 20% on your first order. Now, let's return to the show. Everyone on board the Hoida was gone. The yacht had been equipped with a dinghy and three Carly lifeboats. All were missing. If 25 people had left in the four available boats, each would have been at near capacity. Before the crew of the Tuvalu had even boarded the boat, they could already draw some preliminary conclusions. The Hoida had obviously been without power and at the mercy of the elements for some time, because someone had rigged a makeshift canvas awning as a sunshade over the deckhouse. The kind of thing you do if you find yourself drifting on the open ocean, day after day, with no break from the sun. It was obvious that the ship had been battered by waves because the flying bridge was smashed and the deckhouse windows were open. The portside engine clutch was still disassembled, so investigators knew that the Hoida had still been running on one engine when whatever happened, happened. The other engine was covered with a mattress for reasons that weren't immediately clear. On deck, a doctor's bag was found with surgical implements, a stethoscope, and some bloody bandages. Inside, the radio was found tuned to 2182 kHz, the International Marine Radio Telephone Distress Channel. They had apparently been trying to radio for help. Why hadn't anyone reported a distress call? The Hoida's clocks, powered by the electrical generator, stopped at 10:25, and the light switches for navigation and cabin lighting were in the on position, which seemed to indicate that the Hoida lost power at night. Almost as curious as to what everyone found on board was what they didn't. The ship's logbook, sextant, and other vital navigational tools, plus the firearms that Captain Miller kept in the boat, were missing. Even the absence of the passengers could be seen with suspicion, considering one of them was buying copra for his employer and was carrying about $3,000 in cash. The Hoida was towed into Suva in the Fiji Islands and subjected to a detailed examination under the strictest secrecy, the Eureka Times Standard reported. Under the more controlled conditions in port, much more could be learned. Once righted, the Hoida exhibited a degree of barnacle growth on the port side that confirmed the ship had been listing for weeks. The radio was found to be in working condition. However, a closer inspection of the wire from the radio to the antenna revealed a break which had been painted over, and would have limited the Hoida's radio transmissions to a 2-mile radius. The Hoida's fuel tanks still had diesel in them, and when the approximate mileage was calculated based on the remaining fuel, investigators came to the conclusion that the Hoida made it within 50 miles of Tokelau before it lost all power. Investigators speculated that the mattresses piled on top of the starboard engine were placed there to shield the engine from spray from the prop, likely because the engine continued running for some time after the yacht began to list, and as the port side sunk, the starboard prop rose higher in the water until it eventually flung spray like a kid's bicycle wheel in a puddle after a rainstorm. If that conclusion is correct, you can imagine how dire the situation must have seemed. Chugging along in the dark on a sinking yacht with one engine, that possibility must have felt terrifying. Someone had also rigged an auxiliary pump in the engine room, presumably to keep the rising water from stalling the engines or generators, but it was apparently not connected for reasons unknown. More importantly, investigators found the source of the flooding in the Hoyita's lower decks. In the initial inspection done at sea, someone had speculated that the seacock valves were intentionally opened, either as an act of sabotage or in an attempt to scuttle the ship, to explain the flooding below decks, the source of which was not readily apparent. In Suva, a more thorough inspection revealed a corroded pipe in the raw water circuit of the cooling system had cracked, allowing seawater to infiltrate the bilges. The Hoyita did not have watertight compartments, and the hull would have steadily filled with water. Due to the location of the leak, by the time the crew noticed it, it would have been nearly impossible to find it and stop it. Investigators also found that the bilge pumps were in extremely dirty condition and clogged with debris, which would have made it difficult to pump water out of the ship. 12 days after the Hoyita was found, and with the crew still missing, Harold Gaddy, the managing director of Fiji Airways, still held out hope of finding survivors. If they got onto an island or an atoll, they could live indefinitely on coconut milk and birds and eggs, he said. Likewise, a Hawaiian islander who knew Captain Miller said optimistically, "Dusty Miller is one of those indestructible Britishers, the Horatio Hornblower type. Likely as not, he'll come stumbling out of the bush on some island one of these days and write a book and make himself rich." As the search continued, a formal maritime inquiry was organized to determine what exactly had gone wrong on the Hoyita. The official conclusions included that the Hoyita's hull was sound, but the yacht had not been well maintained. To put it bluntly, it was in extremely bad condition at the time of its voyage. The fractured cooling pipe allowed water to flood the bilges, and as the boat sank lower in the water, the one working engine would have labored and would not have been able to provide enough power to steer. With the hull full of water, it only took one large swell to rock the Hoyita on its side and leave it with a heavy list. Investigators were unable to say, however, what happened to the passengers and the crew based on the evidence that they found. And that's the main question, isn't it? The confounding circumstances of leaving the boat. It just doesn't make much sense. You can't help but feel that if we could just answer this one question, all the other pieces would fall into place. In cold northern climates, there are certain bits of knowledge that everyone knows and accepts. One of them is, if you're traveling in a blinding blizzard and your car breaks down or you get stuck in the snow, don't leave the vehicle. You just don't do it. Although it could be a cold night huddled in the car if the engine stalls, it's better than no shelter at all, and the car makes you a bigger target when search parties come along in the morning. In the nautical world, it's likewise common sense that you don't abandon a floating ship unless it's absolutely necessary. Almost all experienced sailors know this. It's yachting 101. Furthermore, in the specific case of the Hoyita, the captain knew it was virtually unsinkable due to the cork lining in the hull, combined with the empty drums in the cargo hold. Captain E.L. James, harbor master at Suva, later told the Kansas City Times, "She was a very buoyant vessel, very heavily planked and insulated with 5-inch slabs of cork for fish refrigeration in all 3 holds. She also had a number of empty drums in the hold. The vessel would never sink unless she broke up. I just can't understand why everyone would have abandoned her." So, why did they leave the boat? This question gives rise to a number of theories. Captain Miller was an experienced, lifelong seaman of the most knowledgeable sort, descended from 7 generations of seafarers, and several people who knew him believed that he never would have agreed to leave the boat, leading some to propose scenarios which take the captain out of the equation. Perhaps the captain got injured, maybe he lost consciousness. When people finally arrived at the boat, they found the doctor's bag with bloody bandages, so somebody definitely got hurt. Perhaps with the captain unable to offer his guidance, the less experienced crew and panicking passengers chose to leave the listing but floating Hoyita in favor of a dinghy and 3 open life rafts made of canvas with a light metal frame. The injured captain hypothesis, as it has come to be known, also gives rise to another frightening possibility. Was there a mutiny? Before the voyage, there had been friction between ship's mate Chuck Simpson and Captain Miller. The Pasadena Independent described Simpson as an American Indian known for his combination of uncanny physical strength and extremely mild temperament. Simpson had previously told acquaintances that he was done working for Captain Miller, and they were surprised to hear that he had gone on the voyage to Tokelau. Captain Miller's longtime friend, Captain S.B. Brown, speculated that perhaps Simpson and Miller had come to blows and both had fallen overboard in a struggle, leaving the Hoyita without an experienced seaman aboard. According to a theory proposed by John Harris in his book, Without a Trace, The Last Voyages of Eight Ships, Captain Miller was in debt and desperate to complete his journey to get a paycheck. Despite the mechanical trouble of the ship, Captain Miller pressed on until Chuck Simpson and others among the crew revolted and demanded he turn back. There was then a physical confrontation and someone was injured, likely the captain, and everyone then left the ship, with Simpson taking the logbook, navigational aids, and firearms with him. Years later, in an interview with the Honolulu Star Bulletin, a longtime acquaintance of Captain Miller's gave ammunition to the mutiny theory. Miller, he claimed, was broke and could not afford to be choosy about the crew he hired. He had reportedly inherited some members of another ship's crew that were rough characters, and their previous captain had apparently died under suspicious circumstances. Writer Gene Hunter suggested, maybe it was murder at sea. As plausible as a mutiny might seem to explain the disappearance of the passengers and crew of the Hoyita, it does not explain everything. Even if we assume the absence of Captain Miller and Chuck Simpson, were the remaining crew members foolish enough to leave a floating boat? Some of them had been working on boats for 3 or 4 decades, and even the younger seamen had grown up on boats, so would they really abandon the Hoyita? V.G. Boyven, chief surveyor of ships in the Marine Department in Wellington, stated, "So far as I can see from my examination and my investigation of the casualty, the Hoyita would have continued to float in the condition in which she was found indefinitely." Some theorize that after the Hoyita lost power and had been drifting for some time, days or weeks, however long it took the passengers to erect a makeshift awning as protection from the sun, the boat drifted close enough to a nearby island that convinced the occupants to launch the lifeboats and make a run for it. Maybe they made it and died as castaways on some remote island northeast of Fiji. Maybe the currents were too much and they never made it to the island. Instead, swept out to sea to meet their fate as individuals, lost forever in the Neptunian abyss. Of course, there were some more outlandish theories as well. In the days right after the Hoyita mystery broke, more than one small publication with a questionable reputation printed unsourced anonymous rumors that the Hoyita had accidentally sailed right into a Japanese fleet and had been killed or taken captive when they saw something they weren't supposed to. Similar allegations were made concerning pirates, the Soviets, and mysterious submarines that were allegedly seen in the waters where the Hoyita was later found. Two knives that were stamped "Made in Japan" gave rise to theories about a raid by Japanese fishermen. The Fiji Times described the Hoyita as having been stripped. From the story, "The systematic stripping of the ship does not point very strongly to the work of islanders, but rather to a raid under expert instruction." If you read between the lines, it's a clear allegation of piracy, and much has been made of a supposed 4 tons of cargo that were reportedly missing from the Hoyita. It should be noted, however, that in the course of researching the subject, our team found very little in the way of reputable reports of that missing cargo. The Hoyita was carrying little more than some construction materials, food, and medicine. The Kansas City Star listed the cargo as flour, sugar, rice, aluminum stripping, and copper sacks, nothing of any substantial value, and the knives that were stamped "Made in Japan" were later determined to be rusty relics that had been on the boat for years. In February of 1956, an editorial in the Pacific Islands Monthly heavily criticized the bad press that the islands were getting for the ridiculous theories, and assailed the literary judgment of those who printed them. But, nonetheless, the theories persisted. Some believed a natural disaster could be responsible. While most see the battered Hoyita's bridge and deckhouse as evidence that it was assaulted by the waves during its 800-mile drift, a Fiji government official who saw the ship firsthand said that he believed it looked more like it had been hit by a waterspout. A more mundane theory proposed insurance fraud, which to me is an explanation that does not make a ton of sense, so we'll just leave it at that. If you're all in on the insurance fraud hypothesis, feel free to at me after the show. Some have suggested a rogue wave, or a hypothetical underwater sea quake as the potential cause of the Hoiita's condition and the disappearance of its crew. Suggestions which could seem plausible at first glance, but don't seem to fit all the facts on closer examination. Whatever theory you might find yourself favoring, sadly it does not really matter. No sign of the passengers or crew of the Hoiita was ever found. Barring the discovery of the remains of the passengers and crew on some faraway island, we will likely never know what really happened. In 1956, the Hoiita was auctioned for about £2,400, and the new owner overhauled it and put it back to work. However, several groundings in the South Pacific, in 1957 near Korea, and again in 1959 at Nasava, led the owner to sell the boat. In 1962, the Kansas City Times trumpeted, "South Seas ship of tragic mystery floats again," as Robert Maugham, nephew of British playwright William Somerset Maugham, bought the Hoiita. He had plans to write a script and make a movie based on the mystery, but it never came to fruition. The boat was sold again, and a number of other plans for the Hoiita were proposed, including an idea to make it a museum, but it remained on the beach at Nasava. In October of 1961, Pacific Islands Monthly published a story that read, in part, "The Suva City Council is not particularly interested in the fate of the Hoiita, which now lies a rotting hulk on the beach at Nasava, near Lavuka." A local artist had proposed the Hoiita be turned into a nautical museum, from the Pacific Islands Monthly story. The council decided that there was no suitable site at Suva for the Hoiita, and as far as they're concerned, it can rot. And that is where the story of the Hoiita ends. Hoiita remained on the beach, and year after year, tide after tide, disappeared a piece at a time. By the 1970s, visitors began to report that the last piece of the Hoiita had vanished from the beach. A boat born in the fire of a passionate but illicit Hollywood affair, which then became a patrol boat in Hawaii during Pearl Harbor, eventually became a merchant vessel and the last known location of 25 people who vanished from the face of the earth. For the foreseeable future, it's a mystery that will remain unresolved.